Sounds True presents Tape 6 of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry with Jack Kornfield.
Skillful service is born of a quiet heart. Wise intention and skillful service need to be nourished by periods of quiet and prayer. Every great tradition includes some form of the Sabbath. In the West, we inherited the blessing of the Christian and Jewish Sabbath. Muslims have Friday as their holy day, and likewise Hindus and Buddhists renew their vows of simplicity on full moon, new moon, and quarter moon days. When I was young, Massachusetts had Sabbath blue laws requiring all forms of business to stop on Sundays. But now, one generation later, we have 24-hour supermarkets and 24-hour banking 7 days a week. Our consumer society has claimed the right to operate without constraint. This is a recipe for burnout. A spirit of service to one another and to ourselves grows out of a different soil, out of moments of remembering, moments of prayer and blessing. If we pay attention to the cycle of our breath and the beating of our heart, there is a tiny and necessary pause between each. To beat for our whole life, the heart must restore itself in the stillness before each new beat. Spiritual maturity also requires such periods of Sabbath, where we step out of commercial time into that which is timeless. We need to become the sanctuary we seek. This can begin with a Sabbath day or a daily period of meditation and prayer. Sometimes it may require creating regular periods of silence where we work. It can also mean reassessing our lifestyle, moving toward voluntary simplicity, spending time in nature, attending periodic retreats. It may mean turning off CNN and turning on Mozart. In times of difficulty or conflict, it may mean taking a breath, settling the heart, listening silently to our deepest intention. In these moments, we remember our heart's task on earth. A Christian contemplative teacher recalls, "I had lived many years in a small, protected community. Then it came to me that it was time to go back to society to serve. I began an integration, going back and forth. I worked at an AIDS hospice and crisis center. Once a month, I would return to my community, my heart longing for silence. I would stand in line when the gift of food was presented and feel how each thing there, even the most ordinary, was held in a holy way. This is actually how it is all the time. This is the mystery of grace. I knew it wasn't just the prayer or meditation that was important. It was the silence, stopping, taking a breath, opening the heart, seeing that the whole planet and everything on it is holy. I want to bring this beauty with me to everything I touch. So I return to silence regularly. I know if I can stop and remember this, life will fulfill its promise to me." From moments of stillness, the most skillful way to love and serve becomes clear. By stopping to listen, we connect with one another, and true community is born. Awakening with all beings. Gary Snyder says, "The real work is becoming native in your heart, coming to understand we really live here, that this is really the continent we're on, and that our loyalties are here to these mountains and rivers, to these plant zones, to these creatures. The real work involves a loyalty that goes back billions of years. The real work is accepting citizenship in the earth itself." And E.B. White said, "Every morning I awaken torn between the desire to save the world and the inclination to savor it. The mandala of awakening opens the web of life so that we can directly feel our single-stranded breathing together with all that lives. In India, this is called seeing the jeweled net of Indra, the net where each intersection holds the reflective jewel of an individual woven together with and reflecting all the other strands of existence. This deepening connection to the natural world becomes an undeniable reality, bringing with it both responsibility and joy. Chief Seattle said, "What is man without the animals? Without the beasts, men would die of a great loneliness of spirit." Similarly, we might ask, without the earth, how could we walk and dance? Without mountains, where could the snow reside, and where could the snow leopard keep its secret watching? All the earth and its many beings must be included in our wide-hearted practice. Practicing with mountains and rivers. After the Buddha saw the morning star and awakened under the Bodhi tree, he went forth to teach. He chose to begin his teaching in the forest under the trees of the deer park of Sarnath, rather than in the city of Benares 6 miles away. Moses led his people into the wilderness seeking not cities, but a land of milk and honey. Jesus went alone into the same desert, and although he taught in the towns, he returned often to the shores of the sea, the olive groves, the fields and the gardens, and his words were woven with the lives of the shepherd and the fisherman, the lion, the lamb, and the lilies. All spiritual traditions include the natural world in their wisdom, both as a place of refuge and as a manifestation of sacred and natural law. Catholic and Buddhist contemplatives still practice in mountains and forests. Ajahn Buddhadasa, who founded a great forest monastery, speaks of the natural world as our teacher. The organs of our own bodies, arms, hands, lungs, kidneys, function as a cooperative in order to survive. Humans and animals and trees and the earth are interwoven, integrated as a cooperative. The sun, moon, planets, and stars are a giant cooperative. Awakening beyond our self-interest, we find a natural ecology of mind and nature, fresh, open, joyful, where we are organically connected with all things. Modern notions of an ecologically sound culture are not the first. One traditional Indian Buddhist teaching suggests that a person plant a tree for every 5 years of life. And one of the wisest rulers in world history, India's Emperor Ashoka, created a vast kingdom governed by the principles of interconnection. One day, grieving over a particularly bloody campaign to conquer the south of India, Ashoka saw a simple monk walk peacefully across the blood-stained battlefield. Watching this man, the emperor thought, "I, who have everything, am not as happy nor as peaceful as this man who has nothing." Ashoka became the monk's disciple, and the Dharma he learned transformed his land into a kingdom of righteousness. Armies were devoted to keeping peace rather than making war. Religious tolerance, moral responsibility, renunciation were promoted. Vegetarianism was encouraged. Wells were dug. Forests were preserved. And laws were promulgated for the health and well-being of both the people and the land. 2,000-year-old stone pillars carrying Ashoka's edicts and teachings are still found all across India. Unfortunately, wisdom, like the environment, must be continually nourished to flourish. After Ashoka, the stance of many monks and nuns of Asia regarding their interconnection with the earth became passive, without much thought or care for the environment. In the tropical village and forest monasteries of Southeast Asia, you would just throw your trash on the ground. This was workable when the trash was banana leaves, the indigenous wrappers, but it became a nightmare once plastics were introduced. Yet the teachings of most masters still focused almost entirely on the individual mind and did not encourage responsibility for the natural world around us. But then the cutting of the forest of Thailand, Laos, and Burma became so widespread that monks had to become activists to save the last stands of wilderness from the loggers. They began to go out and ceremonially wrap their robes around ancient trees, ordaining them as abbots of the forest. Now monks have become champions of the forests, saviors of the environment. Similarly, in the West, there is a growing Christian ecological movement. Churches worldwide, led by the example of nuns and priests in Latin America, are beginning to include care for the holiness of the natural world as a part of God's way. Human and natural realms are not separate. Whether in contemplating the responsibility of our lifestyle for global warming, or the pollution of our rivers, or in considering the sources of our food, our eyes must open to this interdependence. When we shop in the supermarket, we can reflect on the rain clouds that bring us this food, the moist soil in which it is grown, and the thousand human labors by which it reaches our table. Poet Alison Luderman writes, "Strawberries are too delicate to be picked by machine. The perfectly ripe ones bruise even at too heavy a human touch. Every strawberry you have ever eaten, every piece of fruit, has been picked by calloused human hands. Every piece of toast with jelly represents someone's knees, someone's aching back and hips, someone with a bandana on her wrist to wipe away the sweat." Spiritual life may initially be focused on self-transformation and wise human relationships, but a sense of selflessness must also lead us to our oneness with the mountains. One teacher of yoga reflects, "When I lived in India in the 1970s, one of my gurus taught yoga in a noisy, dirty, polluted city. We learned all about inner purity, but he never mentioned the distress around us. My second guru had an ashram in the country, and there too we studied yoga, meditation, and powerful breathing practices to transcend the world. The environment was still left to fend for itself. I was shocked to see how ecological awareness and the yoga movement were such separate worlds. We thought being vegetarian was enough. Now I take my yoga retreats to pristine places and try to teach how the pure mind and the purity of our rivers and our air are interconnected. It's become necessary to live more carefully and have a world yoga to consciously connect our bodies with the body of the world." Joanna Macy, a visionary Buddhist teacher and activist, points out that for ecological transformation to take place, a spiritual revolution is also needed, a great turning of human consciousness. Even our scientists can see that there is no technological fix, no amount of computers, no magic bullet like the internet that can save us from population explosion, deforestation, climate disruption, poison by pollution, wholesale extinction of plant and animal species, not to speak of continued warfare and racism. We are going to have to want different things, to seek different pleasures, to pursue different goals than those that have been driving us and our global economy. Through spiritual awakening, the values of consumerism are revealed as increasingly shallow and false. Grasping and possessiveness give way to love and integrity, an innermost desire to live in harmony with all creation. There comes a longing to live more simply for the sake of our own hearts, and a growing sense of responsibility for the life of the earth. But this transformation is not automatic. In every area of the mandala of awakening, we need consciously to face our conditioning and habits. To our sadness, the United States remains the largest manufacturer and supplier of weapons worldwide. And we know that the world is spending its wealth in the trillion-dollar arms market, while only 10% of this spent annually could feed all our children, every hungry person on Earth. We have seen that our own growing groundwater pollution affects every one of us. An analysis of PCBs in New York State Mohawk Indians' mother's milk shows that our bodies have become part of the landfill. What are we to do? Spiritual values do not require us to live as renunciates in monastic simplicity, nor to go back to the land. We also need spiritual leaders in politics, in medicine, in law, on Wall Street, in our police forces, in every area of life. The Buddhist story of Bodhisattva Vimalakirti tells how one enlightened being purposely chose to incarnate as a wealthy businessman to bring wisdom to the world of commerce. He then entered the hospitals as a patient to teach compassion to the doctors, and later the bars and brothels to carry the teachings to those within. No realm of human life was outside the range of his compassion. Bringing blessings to all by entering life fully is a noble idea, but we can easily fool ourselves by saying we are following Vimalakirti's example. The riches we enjoy in modern Western society come at great costs, which include the exploitation of other cultures, the economic colonization of much of the world, the ecological devastation of habitats and species, and every time we drive, we contribute to worldwide pollution and global warming. Every time we fly, our jet fuel is secured through the politics of power in the Middle East and the destruction of the caribou range in Alaska. Our desire to eat imported food as inexpensively as possible can have terrible consequences for the farmers and soil of Guatemala and Brazil. In ancient Greek, the word for awakening is alethe. Awakening's opposite is not evil or ignorance, but lethe, or sleep. Even after some experience of awakening, we can be asleep to the consequences of our modern way of living. Sadly, interdependence and ecological understanding are not explicitly taught in most traditional spiritual curricula. We have to educate ourselves to see the invisible costs of our actions until our outer life is in harmony with our heart's true values. To be honorable in these times, we need to extend a moral inventory to our way of life. The Buddhist Eightfold Path includes right thought, right action, right speech, right livelihood. Is the way we are living, our work, our home, our finances, our travel, our level of consumption, our political and social participation, is this way in harmony with our newly enlarged understanding of interconnection? What direction does our care for the earth and our realization of interdependence ask that we move in our life? How might we change, not out of guilt, but out of love? We begin our transformation by the very act of asking these questions. Seeing with the animals, listening with the rivers. At times, we need to step out of our human-centered consciousness altogether. As part of this work to open our awareness of interbeing, environmental activist John Seed has developed a group meditation called the Council of All Beings. These councils have been held all over the world. When participants gather in a place of natural beauty, each group member, for a day or longer, is asked to walk outside and connect his or her heart with the voice of a particular part of the earth, or a particular mountain or river, plant or animal, a heron, a pine tree, a bison, or columbine that seeks to be heard. Then, after making masks or costumes to represent what they have chosen, the members of the group reconvene in council. Each person speaks in the voice of his or her species or place. I am a loon, and I speak for the waterfowl. I am a mountain stream, and speak for the rivers of the world. When all the species are introduced, they begin to bring their concerns to the council. Some members of the group, in their human role, are asked to sit in the center and listen. As a wild goose, I want to tell the council that my long migrations are hard now because the wetlands are disappearing, and the shells of my eggs are thin and brittle. They break before my young are ready to hatch. I fear there is poison in my bones. The council sits with this truth. O humans, I speak as river, bearer of life. Look at what I bear now that you have poured wastes and toxins into me. I have become a carrier of sickness and death. And the council again continues to listen. After all the other species have been given a voice, the humans respond. Usually they voice regrets and fears about human greed and the forces now beyond their control that they have unleashed. The sorrows of the earth that are expressed galvanize their concern for the fate of all species. Then the humans are invited to ask for help from the vast world of nature. The non-humans offer their wisdom and strength. The mountain offers her steady peace. The hawk, a far-seeing eye. The coyote, a playful creativity. The wildflower, a scent to call us back to beauty. The old pine, her unflagging endurance. As in this council, we can learn from nature wherever we are. The plants, animals, and river valleys bring us wisdom and sustenance. They bring the Dharma to us. The great Zen teacher, Master Dogen, once said, "In every bamboo, all Buddhas exist." Yet if this bamboo Buddha were thoughtlessly transported from its native country to our backyard, it might soon become the scourge of our neighborhood if we did not respect its tenacious power as well as its beauty. Whether transporting bamboo or damming rivers, for us to live wisely in the natural world, we must honor its power and integrity, and not imagine we can simply adjust it to our own ideas and convenience. The monks who live in the teak forest love the beauty and shade of its green canopy, but they also respect the strength of the tiger, the poison of the cobra, and the fevers of malaria that the wilderness holds within. All are their teachers. Acting on behalf of all beings. In the Buddhist tradition, a bodhisattva is a being dedicated to universal awakening, to bringing compassion and wisdom to all that lives, however long it takes. One expression of this is the vow not to enter the realm of nirvana until the last blade of grass may also enter. Before every meditation, many practitioners worldwide recite the bodhisattva vows daily as a reminder of this intention. The vows begin in this way: Living beings are numberless. I vow to serve until all are liberated. Ignorance and grasping is boundless. I vow to transform and uproot it all. The vow to bring awakening and compassion to innumerable beings through eons of time is an overwhelming task. Every student who takes such a vow must wrestle with what it means, how it can be lived. Does it mean that I, this small self, must travel around the universe and save all beings? And how can I measure my success? How can I even begin? Quite simply, the Bodhisattva vows do not speak about an accomplishment, but a direction, a setting of intention. No matter what circumstances arise, whether birth or death, joy or sorrow, I commit my body, speech, and mind to the direction of compassion and awakening. In each new moment, I will plant seeds of kindness and liberation for myself and all living beings. The Bodhisattva vows are not a gauge, but a compass, a guide for the heart to follow. They become the source for wise action, the direction from which all else follows. They become our legacy. As Martin Luther King Jr. put it, "I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. I just want to leave a committed life behind." In the midst of the terrible tragedy facing the Tibetan people, the Dalai Lama has often spoken of how important it has been for him to rely on these vows. Over decades of difficulties as a political and spiritual leader and a worldwide exemplar of nonviolence, he has had to make wrenching decisions for his nation and his people. He admits that sometimes he is not sure his decisions are the best ones, that sometimes he has made mistakes. "The only thing I can rely on," he explains, "is my sincere motivation." His heart's motivation is to foster compassion and liberation as best he can in each act. He takes refuge in the seed of intention behind his acts. By planting seeds of goodness, eventually something beautiful grows. To serve all beings, we must remember one more essential truth. It is never too late to begin. When we see with wisdom the heavy press of time, the responsibility for all things is transformed, we find perspective, a long view. We're not in charge. In our relationships, in our community, on this earth, we may not live to see all the changes we work for. We are the planters of seeds. When the seeds of our actions are caring and sincere, we can know that they will bear nourishing fruit for all beings. No matter what has passed, we can begin again. We can only begin now, where we are, and it is this now that becomes the seed for all that lies ahead. Our responsibility, our creativity, is all that is asked. With such sincere motivation, we will naturally ask wise questions and offer true care, tending what we love with a far-reaching wisdom. This is the long-term tending of a farmer for his orchard, of a parent for a child. This broad perspective is that of the elder, the sage. It grows naturally out of a committed life of spiritual dedication. One meditation teacher says, "It's as if my spiritual life has been a slow horse. I started with a lot of ambitions. I tried to gallop in the beginning, doing extensive practice here and in Asia. I was going for enlightenment. I found ecstasy, yes, bliss, mystical states, incredible insight, it all came. But all it did was wake me up to what I had to do. To be a truly happy person, I had to slow the horse down, get really down into the earth, and make my life actually follow my values. Then, after lots more meditation and inner work, I took a 180-degree turn toward the world. Increasingly, I saw how the forest, the oceans, the panda and the krill, the biosphere, depend on me as I depend on them. I became a spiritual activist. I taught it, I wrote about it, I lived it. We had some success, but then again, I had to slow the horse down because my ambition had come back in a new way. Now I understand renunciation better. It's not about monasteries and renouncing life. We're put here to learn the lessons of this human life. It's the renunciation of greed and ambition, of the self-centered ethos of our time. We're not in charge here. We need to be patient, to let our actions come from a simple and pure heart, and from the circumstances in which we find ourselves. Everything good comes from that. Appropriate action, appropriate stillness. In the natural world, we find the teaching of doing and non-doing. Trees bear fruit and fall dormant. Otters, bears, and spotted trout sleep and wake. Day alternates with night, and summer with winter. Often, we feel we must be making a continual effort to enact our bodhisattva intentions, or else we are all failures or lazy. But the wider community of being tells us that without the winter chill months of dormancy, there can be no apples. Stillness, non-doing, listening are as important and essential as action in the mandala of awakened life. Thomas Merton cautions us, to allow oneself to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit to too many projects, to want to help everyone in everything, is itself to succumb to the violence of our times. Sometimes it is necessary to march. Sometimes it is necessary to sit, to pray. Each in turn can bring the heart and the world back to balance. For us to act wisely, our compassion must be balanced with equanimity, the ability to let things be as they are. Just as our passionate heart can be touched by the sorrows of the world, so too we must remember that it is not our responsibility to fix all the brokenness of the world, only to fix what we can. Otherwise, we become grandiose, as if we were put here to be the savior of the humanity around us. Compassion and equanimity come into harmony when we live in the reality of the present. It is very simple. Mindfulness and compassion are genuinely undertaken one step at a time, one person, one moment. Otherwise, we become overwhelmed by all the problems that must be attended to, the dilemmas of our extended family and community, the injustice and the suffering worldwide. Compassion is most real in the particulars, in our response to the immediacy of the moment. Even in global situations, it is this way. It is in the particulars that the mercy of the heart is extended. Whether it is our ailing next-door neighbor, or the one-step-at-a-time building of a worldwide campaign to ban landmines or halt the destruction of rainforest, each day, each step is like breathing, a practice of expanding the heart. In these small steps, our truth and all that is good will blossom. One meditation teacher says, after 30 years of sitting, it seems like even 50 years of practice will be only a short while. Now I take the long view, over lifetimes. My commitment is simple. It is a dedication to the highest aspiration of enlightenment. Time is not the question. It's important that we teach the possibility of becoming utterly free, and that we let every simple act every day be illuminated by this possibility, by this truth. Every prayer and every conscious act contributes to the healing of the whole. Gandhi said, I believe in the essential unity of all that lives. Therefore, I believe that if one person gains spiritually, the whole world gains, and if one person falls, the whole world falls to that extent. In the realm of action, not every gesture must be grand. Small acts are equally important, as can be seen in the story of an old man who was walking along a beach in Mexico after an unusually strong spring storm. The beach was covered with dying starfish tossed up by the waves, and the man was tossing them back in the water one by one. A visitor saw this and came up to him. "What are you doing?" "I'm trying to help these starfish," said the old man. "But there are tens of thousands of them washed up along these beaches. Throwing a handful back doesn't matter," protested the visitor. "Matters to this one," the old man replied, as he tossed another starfish into the ocean. Bearing witness for justice. In one way, our most radical political act is a change of heart. If we want to overcome greed, racism, exploitation, and hatred, to end suffering and bring our lives into harmony with the earth, we must see that the fundamental crisis is in human consciousness. If the world is to be healed, it cannot happen by political and economic means alone. We've seen how the revolutionaries of one generation can turn into the oppressors of the next, and how political power can easily beget greed and delusion. We have to face the forces of separation, of greed, of hate, directly, and learn to live peacefully with a free heart. If we cannot do this, how can we expect it of others? Wisdom tells us the human realm on earth has always included gain and loss, sorrow and joy, greed and generosity, ugliness and beauty. Even so, we cannot deny the cries of today. From a peaceful heart, we recognize a responsibility for alleviating suffering, no matter what the delusion is around us. We draw steadiness and courage from our prayers and meditation. Then, we naturally respond. There comes a growing knowledge that we cannot be complicit with the outrages of the world. As William Faulkner put it, "Some things you must always be unable to bear. Some things you must never stop refusing to bear. Injustice and outrage and dishonor and shame. No matter how young you are or how old you've got, not for kudos and not for cash, your picture in the paper nor money in the bank neither. Just refuse to bear them." Sometimes our most powerful response is to bear witness courageously, and this alone begins to create transformation. Buddhist teacher and activist Joanna Macy tells of conducting her despair and empowerment work in one of the cities closest to the Chernobyl nuclear reactor. The area around Chernobyl was once not known for the partial meltdown of its nuclear plant, but for its beautiful forests and mountains. For centuries, the people living there walked in the mountains, picnicked, gathered mushrooms, fished, hunted, cut firewood. Now, at home and at work, their windows and doors are sealed with tape, and they cannot go outside or they risk radiation poisoning. All they have left are pictures of the forest on the wall. In meeting with community leaders, Joanna pointedly asked, how long would it be before they could return to their forests? One man answered, "Not in my great-grandchildren's lifetime, and not in their great-grandchildren's lifetime. It would be centuries." There was silence. Then a woman stood up and angrily demanded to know why Joanna and her team were rubbing their faces in this sorrow. Joanna sat quietly. Finally, one old man spoke. "At least we can say to our children that we told the truth." After further silence, another woman said, "These visitors come and join together with us for a purpose, to bear witness to our suffering. Now they will return to their own communities and tell our story. They can go out into the world and let others know what happened. They must never let this poisoning of the earth happen in any other place to anyone else's children. With that comment, personal bitterness was transformed into the work of the Bodhisattva. A respected psychologist I know works with the UN, caring for newly arrived refugees who seek political asylum from dictatorships around the world. She sometimes finds it hard to sleep, to let go of the stories and images of torture she hears from refugees of Afghanistan, Uganda, Haiti, Guatemala, Burundi, Bosnia, and so many other countries. It becomes too much for the human heart to bear. We talked about how, because such sorrows cannot be borne alone, she decided to make a large altar where she works, putting there images of Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion, plus Jesus, Buddha, and Mother Mary. Then she added the images of Haitian gods and an Arabic scroll of the Quran's passages of mercy and the images of the benevolent gods of Africa and Latin America. A few flowers, a piece of fruit, are always present. Each day, she calls on the gods and the ancestors of every lineage of earth. She prays that their great spirits will support her and those who bring their sufferings to her. Now she feels she need not carry her burden entirely by herself. The altar is a daily reminder not only of how she has dedicated her life, but of how the great forces of compassion throughout the world are dedicated along with her. The truth of interconnection brings us responsibility, but it also brings us companionship and solace. We do not work alone for change. The great powers of existence work with us. As awakening deepens, reverence and prayer grow. An altar can be one's expression of a concerned heart. The very ritual of turning to an altar is a profound act of rededication. Each time we bow, we can reawaken to the reality that we are not alone. Each time we meditate or pray, chant, or serve, we step beyond the small sense of self. We remember that all beings awaken together. Sometimes, as a bodhisattva, we must act decisively to stop suffering, to no longer allow it. Sometimes the highest response is to simply bear witness. Sometimes our intentions will bring success, at other times we must witness our failure. One of the stories of the Buddha's life tells of the hostilities between the neighboring countries of Magadha and Kapilavatthu, where the Buddha's own Shakya clan lived. When the Shakya people realized that the king of Magadha was planning to attack them, they implored the Buddha to step forward and make peace. The Buddha agreed, but although he offered many proposals for peace, the king of Magadha could not hear them. His mind would not stop burning, and finally he decided to attack. So the Buddha went out by himself and sat in meditation under a dead tree by the side of the road leading to Kapilavatthu. The king of Magadha passed along the road with his army and saw the Buddha sitting under the dead tree in the full blast of the sun. So the king asked, "Why do you sit under this dead tree?" The Buddha answered the king, "I feel cool even under this dead tree because it is growing in my beautiful native country." This answer pierced the heart of the king. Recognizing the commitment and dedication the Shakyas felt for their land, he returned to his country with his army. Later, however, this same king was again incited to war, and this time his army destroyed Kapilavatthu. Shakyamuni Buddha stood by and watched. Becoming the peace we seek can often transform a situation, but even in failure, we can follow our steadfast commitment to compassion. We can, like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stand up for the truth. I still believe that standing up for the truth is the greatest thing in the world. This is the end of life. The end of life is not to be happy. The end of life is not to achieve pleasure and avoid pain. The end of life is to do the will of God, come what may. When we dedicate our lives to bearing witness to truth, our hearts become irrepressible. A Western photographer told me how he had seen this spirit in an old Tibetan nun who had been imprisoned and tortured by the Chinese army for 15 years. After her release, she fled to India, and he wanted to include her wizened face in his portraits of Tibetan elders. As he looked into the large camera lens, he could see her lips murmuring her prayers. When he asked her what had sustained her through these terrible ordeals, she said that no matter what happened, she had never stopped saying prayers of compassion for all beings. In the midst of being tortured, she prayed for her torturers. When they saw her lips moving, they bound her mouth with tape. When they saw the tape moving, they put on more layers, but her prayers would not stop. And when she was free, still her prayers continued. No matter what happened, the nun prayed for the well-being of all. That was her true liberation, her unstoppable true being shining through. Our gift to the earth. Before we awaken, our joy is to use the things of this earth. After the grace of awakening, our joy is to serve the things of this earth. With the growth of wisdom, our life becomes more and more a creative act, an act of service. The beauty of such an understanding is that it excludes no one. In the traditional culture of Bali, there is no word for artist, no particular group of creative people, no idea of those who serve and those who do not. Each person must offer his or her particular gift, and each act serves the gods. Sacred music, dance, painting, song, story, mystical trance, prayer are blended with the cooking of a meal, the planting of crops, the driving of a cart. All is actively held as worthy. All being is connected to the gods.